And let me turn my camera on. There we are. Well, good morning. It is Monday morning, July 6th. This is Chem 3. And I had a couple of announcements for this morning. So over the weekend, I put up another answer key. And since we've got the screen share up, I guess I can show you that I've got the Chapter 3 answer key up for you guys. And it's already connected on Canvas, and you can find it at the Chem3, at the chemed.study website. Funny, it's looking like, oh, I know why. There's a lot more here because it starts way at the beginning. So I have the annotated answer key up there for you guys as well. That should help with studying for Chapter 3. I have a new Chapter 4 assignment that I will put up this afternoon, and I will create that Chapter 4 answer key this afternoon as well. And that will give us more nomenclature practice and things. But within Chapter 4, we also get the Lewis structures and the VSEPR theory. And I kind of wanted to go through VSEPR a little bit before I turned you loose on a homework assignment on that. And as we've said, the reading through Chapter 4, all of Chapter 4 is good to read. So there's nothing there that I'm really cutting out reading-wise. So that's an important update. The other update that I've got is my computer system seems to be unstable this morning, and it crashed on me once. We'll see how it does. If it does crash, the iPad stays on. I usually figure it out pretty quickly, communicate with you guys through the iPad while I reboot the system. And I took time during the break between lab and lecture to reboot my computer one more time and try to stabilize things. So I think, crossing my fingers, knocking on wood, I think I've got this sorted out at this point. And that means that we pick up where we left off. So on the second, I'm just taking a look to see where we ended really quickly. We ended by looking at formal charge. And we were doing some formal charge examples. And we had these common bonding patterns along with formal charge. And maybe what we ought to do is another example or two of Lewis structures and formal charge, and then launch into VSEPR theory. So I'd like to be able to get into VSEPR theory and starting to look at three-dimensional structure of molecules today. That's sort of my goal of how far I would like to get today. And we may not be entirely able to complete Chapter 4, but we should get a good part of the way through Chapter 4, but almost finishing it. So that's the goal for today. All right, let's see. I don't have my chat up, and I kind of rely on that. And the participants list is really nice to have up too. Okay, I'm feeling more in shape now to handle this. So let's start a new note for today. And what we're going to do is still be in Chapter 4.4, Lewis structures. And what we're hitting is formal charge. And octet exceptions. And these kind of go hand in hand, that usually what we want to do, the goal is to reduce formal charges as much as possible. In favor of octet exceptions. So in other words, formal charges, when they're present in a molecule, sometimes they have to be present in a molecule. Sometimes there's no other way around the formal charges. The formal charge is a result of ions. So ions always have formal charges. For instance, a PO43 minus or a CO32 minus or SO42 minus, these will always have formal charges in their structure. However, there are other structures that should not have formal charges. And these, PO43 minus, carbonate, sulfate, these ions, even though they will have some formal charges, they should have the minimum number. We'll always have formal charges, but should the same as the charge state. Others that are neutral should not have any formal charges in them most of the time. And so it's this goal of trying to reduce down the number of formal charges in a molecule as much as possible in favor of octet exceptions. And why do we do that? Because when we look at energy of a structure, and so we look at sort of this energy diagram. Formal charges are higher in energy than octet exceptions. For period 3 and below. In the periodic table. And there's evidence to show this, that there are experiments that we can do that demonstrate this to be true, that when we look at the structure of molecules, that we find that the octet exceptions, and really this octet exceptions is an amendment of the Lewis structure sort of model, and that we find that we need to make those exceptions in order to be more consistent with experiments that we see when we do experiments on the molecules. And so we think of these octet exceptions as being lower in energy than drawing structures that have formal charges in them. And so we try to draw them without the formal charges. We try to use these octet exceptions when we can. So what are these octet exceptions? When we go through the octet exceptions come into play for elements that are period 3 and below. So when we look at period 1 in the periodic table, in period 2 and 3 and 4, in period 1, we have hydrogen. In 2 and 3 and down to 4, we have those elements. Now we can come back up without having to bring a specific periodic table into it. So it'll allow us to kind of look and see, and our table keeps going down below this. We have hydrogen and helium and lithium and beryllium and boron, carbon, nitrogen and oxygen and fluorine and neon. These elements here in period 2, everything here and up obeys the octet rule. And that octet rule comes from not the 1s, but really the 2s and 2p that holds 2 electrons and 2p that holds 6 electrons. And so that's a total of 8 electrons in principle energy level 2. But when I get to level 3, level 3 has, where's my periodic table? Level 3 has sodium and magnesium and aluminum and silicon and phosphorus and sulfur and chlorine and argon. And these elements that are down here, these can have octet exceptions. They don't have to. They don't always, but they can. And where that comes from is that in principle energy 3, there are the 3s, there are the 3p, and there are the 3d. That's 2, 6, 10. That's a total of 18 electrons. And so when I have an element that is in principle energy level 3, I have the 3s, the 3ps, and the 3ds. And so let's say that I have electrons that are in this system. This is like an extra shelf that can hold electrons. And so these elements that are in period 3 and below can reach up into those d orbitals and can stack electrons into those d orbitals. And what we see is we see exceptions that are 10 electrons, 12 electrons, and 14 electron exceptions. So that is 2 extra, 4 extra, 6 extra electrons that are stacking into these d orbitals. And yes, for some elements, as these elements get into the transition metals, they can go all the way up to 18. But mostly what we're going to be dealing with is we're going to be dealing with this range here from 10 up to 14. And I don't believe we'll hit anything more than 14 in terms of the electron exceptions or exceptions to the rules that we will see. And those exceptions for families are very particular in that for group 5A, what we see with phosphorus is a particular exception that looks like this. This is a 10 electron exception that phosphorus utilizes. In 6A, sulfur. Sulfur likes to utilize 2 different exceptions. One is this, which is a 10 electron, and the other is a 12 electron. And it depends on what it's bonding to as to whether it does one or the other. And in group 7A, we wind up seeing 3 different patterns. 7A starting off with chlorine, we see a pattern which is 10 electrons. We see a pattern which is 12 electrons. And we get a 14. And so this is 14 electrons in this system. And of course, all those elements that come after them in the family can access those same bonding patterns. And so these are common bonding patterns that we see happen. And so we can take and we can do some Lewis structures now and just show how we can use these octet exceptions and why the octet exceptions are important. And then from there, I think we'll launch into VSEPR theory. So let's do a couple of examples. Sulfate is a good one because I didn't do sulfate in the morning. So this allows us to be able to see another structure. I don't think I did sulfate. This will work. Let's do the electron count. We have sulfur and oxygen. There is 1 and 4. And this oxygen is in 6A. Sulfur is in 6A. They're both in 6A, so they each have 6 electrons. So that's 6, and 6 times 4 is 24. So I've got 30 electrons that are in my system, except this negative charge. The negative charge tells me that there are 2 extra electrons. Those 2 extra electrons need to be added in to my electron count so that my electron count is complete. So there's my 2 extra electrons. Following the system that I would have done normally, I would take and bond each oxygen to the sulfur once. In so doing, I would then take and give each outer element a complement of electrons in order to get to an octet. 2, 4, 6, and the bond makes 8. The bond is 2, 4, 6, and 8. 2, 4, 6, and 8. The bond, 2, 4, 6, and 8. And so this structure, we would now do an electron count. We'll then look at octets, and then we'll do formal charge.
So if in the original formula, it didn't have a negative 2 charge, what you just wrote is like the neutral version of SO4.
SO4 is not, I don't think there is an SO4. There's an SO2. And we can look at SO2. I think there's an SO3. SO3 is actually a little bit harder to do its Lewis structure. It's a little bit non-standard. Maybe we can look at SO3 after this one. But yeah, what I would do is I would just not add in. I'd do the same process. I just wouldn't add in the extra electrons for the charge. That's the only thing that would be different. Okay, so in the electron count, I've got 8 times 4. So 8 times 4 is 32. I've got 32 electrons, and that's giving me a good count. If I go through and look at octets, I've got 8 electrons around the oxygen. So that's 8, 8, 8, 8. Every oxygen has an octet. And in fact, I think what I'll do is when I'm doing octets, I think I'll do it by element. So oxygen is demonstrating octets for all of them. And sulfur, likewise, 2, 4, 6, 8. Sulfur is demonstrating an octet for all of them. So that's true. Formal charge now. Formal charge, if we remember, there was a definition that we used for formal charge. Formal charge says, that I take the valence electrons minus 1/2 the bonding minus the non-bonding. So let's do for oxygen. Oxygen is in 6A. So that's 6. That's going to be my valence electrons. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a look at one of the oxygens here, and we're going to say that these electrons here in this bond are my bonding electrons. So I'm going to do 1/2 of those. And then my non-bonding are these guys out here. And so to do that formula, my formula is going to look like 6 minus 1/2 of 2 minus 2, 4, 6, minus 6. So 6 electrons for the non-bonding, 2 for the bonding, and my valence was 6 to start off with. That is 6 minus 1 minus 6. That equals a minus 1. So the formal charge here is a minus 1 charge on that oxygen. And I would venture to say that each of these oxygens, if I were to do their formal charge, would be exactly identical because they're all bonded exactly identically. Let's repeat that process for the sulfur, and we'll look at sulfur's formal charge. So for sulfur, what's going to change is I'm going to look at there, the bonding, and there are no non-bonding. So sulfur is in group 6A. There's my valence from the periodic table. So formal charge is going to equal 6 minus 1 half of 8 minus 0. That is 6 minus 1 half of the bonding electrons minus the non-bonding, and there are 0 non-bonding electrons. So that is 6 minus 4, which equals a plus 2. So this sulfur is in a plus 2 state. There are a lot of formal charges in this structure. Too many formal charges. So on my formal charges, the structure is failing on the formal charge. So how do I reduce formal charge? To reduce formal charge, make double bonds.
Question?
Yeah.
There are too many because we want a minus 2 charge, is that correct?
There are too many because we would only like to see 2 formal charges. We would either like to see just a single 2 minus, or we would like to see 2 individual minuses, but we don't want to see multiple minuses and positives canceling each other out. The net charge is 2 minus, and that's okay. But the idea is to try to reduce down the number of formal charges to a better structure. The more charges there are, the higher in energy the structure is. So the idea is to try to reduce down the number of formal charges such that it becomes equivalent with the net charge on the molecule.
That 2 minus.
That's okay. What we're striving to try to get.
Okay.
So we're going to reduce formal charge, or to reduce formal charge, make or break double and triple bonds. Let's just leave it at double bonds for now. Usually, taking negatives and making a double bond with a positive. So for instance, when we take the structure, and this structure has a 2 positive for the sulfur, and each oxygen has a minus, and it doesn't matter which oxygen I choose, but I choose one of them, and I move the electrons in to make a double bond with the sulfur, that will reduce down two of the charges. If I take this lone pair and push it in to make a double bond, what it does is it knocks down the formal charge on the sulfur by one, and it gets rid of the negative charge on the oxygen. This now has one, two, three negatives, and sulfur is now in a plus one state. So I'll do that again, and it doesn't matter which oxygen I choose. I could do any of the three. It's customary to do the top and bottom, but it really makes no difference.
Is there a reason why that's customary? It's just how it ended up happening?
Yeah, it's just convention. But like I said, it is usually drawn this way, but it makes absolutely zero difference. I could have the two double bonds next to each other, and structurally it's exactly the same. So it really makes no difference. Now when I look at formal charge, now what's happening is each of these oxygens is in a zero formal charge state. And the sulfur is in a zero formal charge state. And I only have the two negatives. This is the best structure. And it's the lowest in energy. And it is also consistent with experimentation. So that this is what we see when we actually analyze the structure and look at it through experimentation. And if we go through and we do the formal charge and we count up the formal charge, we can analyze the sulfur and the oxygen again. So we can go through and we can say, all right, oxygen, this is 6, subtract, we'll do it for the guy up here. This is 6, subtract 2, 4, 1/2 of 4. And subtract 1, 2, 3, 4, subtract 4 non-bonding. So what I'm doing is I'm taking my valence, which is 6A. So we take the 6A, take the valence number, subtract 1/2 of the bonding electrons, and subtract the non-bonding electrons. That's going to equal 6, subtract 2, subtract 4. There's the zero formal charge for the oxygen. The sulfur, we could do the same thing. Sulfur is also in 6A. So this is going to be 6, subtract 1/2 of 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. Subtract 1/2 of 12. Subtract 0 because of the non-bonding. So let me change colors a little bit. And we'll keep the red consistent because that's group 6A. But let's change and look at sulfur's bonds as being sort of this purpley color. So I have to hit that twice. There's the 12 electrons. And then the non-bonding will make a different color altogether because there are no non-bonding on sulfur. So that is 6 minus 6 equals 0. So the sulfur likewise has a 0 charge. And so that structure, when we go through and do all of our checks, checks out on every checkbox. Electrons used should be 32. Octets We'll check that and formal charge. So now, we'll draw it the right way. We'll put the 2 minus on the outside. We have used 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24, 26, 28, 30, 32. We've used 32 electrons. So the electron count is good. Octets, this oxygen has 2, 4, 6, 8. This oxygen, 2, 4, 6, 8. Bottom oxygen, 2, 4, 6, 8. Left, 2, 4, 6, 8. Everybody has an octet. Oh, we didn't count sulfur. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. But 12 is okay for sulfur. So 12 electrons on sulfur, and that's okay. So that's an octet exception for sulfur, and that works. And formal charge, I have for formal charges, if I go in and place them in here, 0 for oxygen, 0 for sulfur, 0 for the lower oxygen, minus 1, and minus 1 for each of those oxygens, which is consistent with the number of charges that I have out there, my formal charge likewise checks off. So I've checked off basically all of my boxes, and I have a good structure. So that's what I want to do in going through and just making sure that everything matches.
When we write a final answer for this, do you want us to include the negatives inside of the bracket, or is that implied in the 2 minus?
It's not implied in the 2 minus, but anybody understanding formal charge could read this and could see where the formal charge is coming from. And so you get, this is technically correct to not include the charges in on the individual atoms. It's correct just to leave the charge out here. When we get into organic chemistry later on, it is also correct to think of it this way and to put the minus charge associated with each oxygen. And sometimes we don't even draw the lone pairs because we learn to see the lone pairs. We know how many lone pairs there are on everything. So sometimes within organic chemistry, we're even leaving off the lone pairs. But it's utilized more this way in organic chemistry so that I actually see where the negatives are rather than thinking about it this way and delocalized. This is more of an appropriate Chem 3, and all the answers in the back of the textbook are going to be drawn in this way, in this format. So we'll be consistent with that. I think that's why I keep switching back and forth between patterns, is because I teach two different systems, and in my mind, I'm so accustomed to doing one, sometimes it's hard to convert into the other. Okay, so what patterns are allowed with that? The patterns that are allowed with that are the ones that we showed before. Phosphorus has a pattern that looks like this. It is a double bond and 3 singles. Sulfur can have 1 double bond and 2 singles, and it gets a lone pair, or 2 double bonds and 2 singles. That's the 10 and the 12 electron exceptions. And then chlorine, and honestly, we really don't see chlorine very much. If you're going to put emphasis on anything, put emphasis on remembering these 3, because this is what you run into the most. Why do we use those the most? Let me show you at the bottom of the screen why we use those the most. We use those the most because, number one, this structure is the phosphate ion. This is PO4 3-. So PO4 3- as the phosphate ion is used a lot. It's an extremely important ion, not only in that it gives rise to phosphoric acid, so H3PO4 would be phosphoric acid, and that structure comes into play, but this phosphate is extremely important in terms of DNA and RNA, and ATP. And all of those types of structures, biological structures, so this is H3PO4. But we also find it as part of the phosphate backbone. So we find this, find in ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It's the phosphate component of ATP, and that structure resides in there. We see it in DNA, DNA. So those nucleic acids and the DNA structure, it is the backbone, the phosphate backbone. To the DNA molecule and also an RNA. Same thing, part of the phosphate backbone. So we find it in a lot of enzymes. We find it in structures that communicate energy. We find it in storage. We find it all over in biological sciences that phosphate structure is conserved, and we see that all over the place. The sulfur, when we look at the sulfur, the main thing that we think of there is the sulfate ion. And the sulfate ion is part of sulfuric acid. So this is a 2-, and this is the SO4 2- sulfate ion. And the sulfuric acid structure. And because these are just such common reagents that we see these structures all the time. So we see those 10 and 12 electron exceptions a lot for the phosphorus and the sulfur. And we don't see the chlorine a lot. The chlorine just doesn't come into play a whole lot. So that's why I tend to focus on these. So if you're going to
say,
go ahead, Jeremy.
Is there a way to tell that, hold on, is there a way to tell that something is an acid just by looking at the Lewis structure?
Yes. It's pattern recognition. Acids tend to have a structure that is some element double bonded to an oxygen, single bonded to an oxygen and a hydrogen. And is this hydrogen that is acidic. And there may be other things connected here. But it is this overall pattern that you were looking for that is the double bond connected to that center element. And that center element can be many different things. It can be a phosphorus, it can be a sulfur, it can be a carbon. And so what we see is that we see acids that are like this that are carboxylic acids. So we recognize that structure. The phosphorus with a double bond and an O and an H with other things connected to it. This is a phosphoric acid. And that double bond with a sulfur, O and H, and some other component here, maybe even down here. This is a sulfuric acid derivative. And so we're capturing that pattern of recognizing an acid and then the hydrogen connected to it. Yeah, and we see many different types of acids. So it's that recognition. It just comes down to pattern recognition. There's nothing else that really indicates to you that that is true, that it's an acid when it has those structures, but that's the main thing that those acids have. And I think that we could also call that true for nitric. That if I wanted to do nitric acid and double bond O, OH, that this is the same pattern that we would see for nitric acid. So that pattern is conserved and is true for all acids. Well, I mean, there are other acids beyond that. I should not generalize to that, but this is the easiest way to recognize an acid. And then there are some other patterns that give rise to very acidic protons as well, but this is the main pattern.
Cool. Thank you.
That's kind of cool. Where do I need to go from here? Lewis structures, formal charge, resonance, which I'm not going to do a lot on. I want to start VSEPR theory. What time is it? It is 11 o'clock. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do VSEPR theory. Let's call it a 10-minute break. That's a good spot to stop for a second. And I'll put some music on, and we'll come back, and we'll do some VSEPR theory.
conceive speaks of thinness. Radically, my fashion dreams, costume in and model scream. Fame is nothing more than forced duress.
Okay, I think we're coming back here. I think that was 10 minutes. I think we stopped at about 11:04, 11:05. Quick Pandora. I got the screen share back up. And what I want to start is VSEPR theory. VSEPR theory is actually quite fun and is not complicated, unlike so many other things that we're doing. VSEPR theory is pretty simple. and I was looking for the textbook, which I closed for some reason. The reason that I want the textbook open is because usually I don't teach the extended part of VPR theory. I usually teach a very small part of it. And I think that's what we're going to do, but I want to be able to give you sort of the bigger picture, but then tell you where we're going to stick sort of in our wheelhouse. So VSEPR theory stands for valence shell electron pair repulsion theory. Oh, and I should be able to see everybody's, yeah, I can still see everybody over there. Okay. VSEPR theory. This is valence shell electron pair repulsion theory. VSEPR. That's where it comes from. And basically what it says is that in the valence shell, electron pairs repel. That's all it really says. Is that electrons, being like charges, repel one another. And that the valence shell electrons are the ones that are repelling one another and resulting in geometry. So the valence shell electrons, and we'll say the electron pairs, repel one another leading to three-dimensional geometry. And the thing here is that it's not just electron pairs that are repelling one another. It is also elements that have electrons on them. So we can think of it as being sort of an electron pair, or we can think of it as an atom, let's say X, that has electrons on that atom, that this also repels. So it is not just an electron pair that repels, but also other atoms that have electron clouds on them, they also repel, and they try to seek to find the most amount of space that they can around a central element. And as we start to draw these three-dimensional structures, there's a couple of different types of bonds that we need to be aware of. So one type of bond is called a wedge bond. Usually it's solid and we shade it in and it looks like a wedge. And the interpretation means that this wedge bond, when we use it, is coming out towards you. And then we have a bond that we call the hash bond. And the hash bond is a bond that is going back away from you. And a bond which is a straight bond, this is just, we'll call it a line bond, for lack of some other things. This is in plane, meaning that if I have a piece of paper, and think about a piece of paper that is sitting here, and some molecule, that the bonds that are straight are in the plane with the piece of paper, and the one that is a wedge bond is going back in space, and this one is coming out in space. So that if I look at that and my carbon is sitting here my wedge bond is going back. Excuse me, my hash bond is going back. My wedge bond is coming forward. And then those other bonds would be in plane with the paper and would be coming out towards me in essence. So that's the way that that is interpreted in terms of the different bonds that we see there. This representation really doesn't do it any good or any justice, but here we come forward and back and in plane. Okay, and as we start to look at these, I typically start with one family and work my way down. I typically like to start with a family that is connected to four different things and look at the families and the geometries and then work backwards from that. The family actually starts earlier than this, such that within the families, within the families of geometries, we have the number of, let's call it groups, and the number of groups attached to central. They start off at 6. Let me, even before I do this, let me do some other definition before I even do this. A, this equals central atom. So we're pulling it from A. X equals atom attached to central. And E, this equals a lone pair of electrons. And so what we can do is we can look at the families and we can have the number of groups attached to a central as being 6, 5, 4, 3, or 2. And we don't tend to go down below 2. And out of those groups attached, there are different geometries. And out of these possible geometries, we get an AX6. An AX5E, an AX4E2, an AX3E3, and an AX2E4. All of these, when I combine the E's and the X's, all have 6 things attached to the central element. And so they all fit within this geometry family that is of 6 things attached to the central. And so the 6 things are atoms and combinations of atoms and lone pairs. Each one of these geometries gets its own name and has a specific geometry associated with it. As we go to the 5, we drop down and we look at AX5. AX4E, AX3E2, and finally AX2E3. When we go to 4, we start here, AX4, AX3E, AX2E2. When we get down to 3, we start at AX3, and AX2E. And the last one is just AX2. And so we start our analysis for this class. We like to look at just these families here. And we try to get down the names of 6 different geometries. So we will learn and memorize these 6 geometries. These guys up here, these you learn and memorize in Chem 1A. We can look at them still. And it's kind of fun, but to memorize all of those names gets a little overwhelming. And so what we do is we stick down here with just 6 of these different geometries. But I wanted to show you sort of how this all comes together and how this all looks. And now what we'll do is we'll take these families and build from these families. And I'll show you 3-dimensional pictures of these families that we can rotate and we can move around and we can look at it. And what about AXE5? AXE5 probably does exist, but it doesn't have a specific geometry name because there's no 3-dimensional structure with just 2 things that form a dumbbell. So you need 3 things in order to be able to have a bond angle. So we're looking at having A and the different X's, and we look at the bond angle between them of what that angle is, and that's how we keep track of what the different geometries actually are, is by that bond angle. And when you have A connected to X, there's no bond angle because there's no third element. And so we drop off and we stop. You notice that all of these have AX2, 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 AX2 with a different number of E's, but they all have the ability to form a bond angle between 3 different components. So that's where that's coming together. And why does the E get dropped in the first iteration of each? Because in the first iteration of each, we are looking at what is the geometry that can be formed by having 6 things connected to a central element, or 5 or 4 or 3 or 2, and then dropping them down, eliminating one of each of those groups and adding lone pairs each time. So if I start with just the 6 option is the easiest one to start with, even though we're not going to spend time on the names. What happens is if I have the A, so this is octahedral geometry. This will be the octahedral family. The octahedral family starts with an A and 6 things bound to the A, 6 X's. And this is what we call octahedral. And it is the AX6. The next stop down, when I replace one with an E, what I wind up doing is putting a lone pair in place of one of the, for lack of a better term, substituents. That's what we call them. And so this one has the X's like this. And we give this one a different name. This one is called the square pyramid. This is an AX5E. Then I go to the next one, which has 2 lone pairs. Those 2 lone pairs fall top and bottom. And this is the AX4E2. And this one is called square planar. And they are, the names, interestingly enough, are coming out of the geometry that is actually being formed. So when I look at sort of the geometry that is formed here, I form an object that I got to do like a line in the back, that if you have ever played role-playing games with dice and an eight-sided dice, the octahedral dice, this forms an eight-sided object, which is an octahedron. And so we call it octahedral. This one forms a pyramid that I can take and look at the pyramid that it forms. And so we get the square base and pyramid, square pyramidal. This one just forms the square in a plane. And so it is square planar. And that's where the names of these come from, is we make up a name based on the geometry. The next one would have three lone pairs. And as three lone pairs, what we get is something that is T-shaped. So this one is called T-shaped because the X's literally appear in a T. And this is the AX3E3. And then we would have a linear one. I'd have one more that would go into this family. So the last one that would go into this family would be an A with the X's separated top and bottom. And all of the lone pairs around the center. And this one is called linear. This is the AX2. E4. And that would be that whole family. And so what the reason that we're starting it each family with the X's is because we want to see what the parent geometry is, because the parent geometry gives name to the family. So the parent geometry where there are no lone pairs, that is the name of what we call the entire family. Okay, so Eric, so the square pyramid is going downwards in space. Yes, however, that's in space, it can be always turned and rotated and oriented in a different way. So I could always turn that pyramid over. And the octahedral is the square pyramid, but with two mirrored sides, which is correct. So there are two mirrored sides. It's like two square pyramids stacked on top of each other, base to base. And that is exactly what the octahedral looks like. And so when I do these families have names. This is the octahedral family. The fifth family is called the trigonal bipyramidal family. The fourth family is the tetrahedral, which did not fit in there the way I wanted it to, so I'm going to start it back a little bit. The third is the trigonal planar. And the second linear. And so we're starting here. We're starting at tetrahedral family, trigonal planar family, and linear family. I know I started with the octahedral because I wanted you to see the extent of like an entire family and what that looks like. But let me start from the tetrahedral and then show you molecules that fit within that. And we can always extend out to these other geometries if you guys are curious, or if we want to, or we want to see geometries that look like that. So let's take tetrahedral family. What I'm going to do is I'm going to construct a table. That table is going to have the abbreviation. A molecule. The what I call the electronic structure, the molecular structure, and a bond angle. The abbreviations that we're using are the AXE abbreviations. And the first one that we're going to start with is we're going to start with AX4. And a molecule that fits this is CH4. The electronic structure, when we look at it, we call this thing tetrahedral. Its molecular geometry is likewise tetrahedral. And its bond angle is 109.5 degrees. So what does this look like? Where do we get these names? When we take and put four things around a central element, it turns out the farthest distance that they can get apart is 109.5 degrees. So the bond angle between all of these is 109.5 degrees. If I set that little object down on the table and look at that object sitting on the table, it has an A and these X's that would sit on the table and an X up here. And if I draw the geometry that results from that, that geometry is a four-sided object. And that four-sided object, because there's a bond that comes down this way too, that object forms a little pyramid. A four-sided pyramid. And we call that tetrahedral, or a tetrahedron as a four-sided object. The difference between the electronic structure and the molecular structure is that the electronic structure, we say that we can see the electrons. And in the molecular structure, electrons are invisible. So this electronic structure really is what we're calling the parent structure. And we will see that everything in this family will be tetrahedral, but that their molecular structures, the names of their molecular structures, will change because we won't be able to see the lone pairs of electrons. Let's go get an image of this methane molecule and see what methane looks like in three dimensions. See if I can make this work. So I want to go to Chemistry Apps, WebMo, and I would like to go to why can I never figure out how to get into, oh, there we go, Job Manager. I was doing it right. And Chem3 models, and let's start off with methane. Here's methane. And the methane molecule, ooh, which is doing some funky things. It keeps changing my center of mass. Maybe that will center it up. Nope, the center of mass is all messed up now. I'm gonna go back to the job manager and grab it one more time just to keep the center of mass where I want it. Okay. So what you can see is that I can orient this in a way that is very similar to what I'm drawing, where number 5 is going back, 4 is coming forward, 2 and 3 are in the plane. So 2 and 3 are sort of the straight bonds, 5 would be a hash, and 4 would be a wedge. And that's the way that I've drawn it on my paper. So if I flip back, and we look at that, we can see the numbers there. Let's see, we'll get those numbers off of them. 5, 4, 2, 3. So it is 5, 4, 2, and 3. So 4 and 2, 4 is the hash, 2 is the wedge. Nope, I did it wrong. 5 and 4, I messed up 2. See, that's why I should not try to go back and forth. Oh, they're all messed up. So this is 5. Is that 4 and this one's 2? Yeah. Okay. So we can see what that molecule looks like. And I don't know if you're going to be able to see this, but I'm going to click on that hydrogen, the carbon, and the next hydrogen. And down in the lower left-hand corner, can you guys see? I can't blow it up. You're just going to have to look down in the lower left-hand corner. It says 109.468. It gives me the bond angle and tells me the bond angle between those three atoms is 109.5, essentially. Watch what happens if I select three others. 109.5. If I select the back one, 109.5. They're all 109.5. It doesn't matter which three I go with. They're all 109.5. And so the bond angle is 109.5 for all of these. And that's what defines something that is in the tetrahedral family, is that 109.5 bond angle. If I go to the next geometry, the next geometry in this family is an AX3E. A molecule that exemplifies this is ammonia, NH3 with a lone pair. We can do a couple of different molecules, but this is enough for right now. The nitrogen, the lone pair, occupies space and takes up volume and pushes the X's, in this case the hydrogens, to the bottom of the molecule. So the hydrogens can't all sit in a plane because this is electrons that are negatively charged and they push on these guys, repelling them. Remember that we get those repulsive forces that are pushing down. And so as this lone pair pushes down on these hydrogens, it takes on a geometry that is a little bit like a squat pyramid. And so the pyramid that I see here is sort of this geometry. And if I could draw that and see the sides of it, what I would see is I would see a little pyramid. Not quite the full tetrahedron that I was seeing before. It's still a tetrahedron, but it's squat. It's more like a pyramid. And that's the name that we give it. We give it trigonal because of three things bound to it. Pyramidal. And that's the name that I use for that, trigonal pyramidal. Or a trigonal pyramid. And its electronic structure, when I can see the lone pairs, when the lone pairs are visible, is called tetrahedral, because that's the parent. So it has an electronic tetrahedral geometry, it has a molecular trigonal pyramidal geometry, and its bond angles are idealized at 109.5. What we find is that they're actually less. They're probably somewhere closer to 100 and I want to say 5, but maybe it's closer to like 107 to 105. We can go see what it is. We'll go measure it and see what it actually is. So let's go look at that structure. We need to go back to the job manager and I need to grab ammonia. And the difference with ammonia is notice that we can't see the lone pairs. The lone pairs are missing. I can actually bring the lone pairs into the picture so that we can see where they are. Maybe, possibly. Can I do that? Results. Close. Usually it allows me to. Calculate. Orbitals. Molecular. Four. Oh, and I lost it. Where did it go? There's a certain type of orbital that I would like to be able to calculate, which it won't let me. I'd have to do the calculation ahead of time. But what this is showing is this is showing one of the orbitals that looks a lot like a p orbital, and the electron density resides in that top blue part, and pushes the hydrogens down, repelling the hydrogens down into the bottom part of the molecule. And you can see how much space it literally takes up and occupies. So from that, what we can do is we can also look at the bond angles. So let me look at the bond angles. Hydrogen. Oh, reset, come on. Okay, now maybe it'll let me do it. Hydrogen, nitrogen, hydrogen. 109. So it is still close. This one's 109. Probably because I didn't do this at a very high theory. That if I did it at a higher theory, it's still less than 109.5. It is 109. But the bond angle shrinks slightly because the lone pairs repel more than other elements. So the lone pairs actually exert a bigger force and make the bond angle slightly smaller, but we still use the idealized bond angle. So this is 109.5 that we'll say. And the last one that we can do is an AX2E2. Best molecule to demonstrate this one, H2O, of which we normally write the H's on the right-hand side, H2O. And we'll put two lone pairs on the oxygen. This molecule has two H's and two lone pairs.
Why is it that we write H2O that way?
Because those hydrogens can be thought of as being acidic. And we have a standardized process of writing acidic protons on the left-hand side of a molecule. It is just the way in which we write acids with their acidic protons on the left and non-acidic protons on the right. And the virtue, by virtue of those two protons being connected to an oxygen and being acidic, we just, it's by convention that we write them on the left.
Got it. Interesting.
Yeah. And this molecule, when we look at it, is still tetrahedral. And I can think of it as writing it this way. The two lone pairs occupy space and the bond angle is still close to 109.5. And when I can't see the lone pairs, what I see is something that looks bent like a boomerang. And so that's what I call it. I call it bent, and it's bent 109.5 because we're gonna have another bent in here. And it's still tetrahedral for its electronic geometry. So if I go back and show you the water molecule and see what that looks like. We go back to the job manager and methane, water. There's the water molecule. And you can see its bent nature. And we can look at its bond angle, which is 103. This one is dramatically decreased from 109. The 103 is because the two lone pairs now are really compressing the hydrogens. And if I wanted to, I could look at the lone pairs on this one. I can't display them both at the same time, so that's problematic. But we could see where those lone pairs are. One of them is here. So I can see how that occupies space. And the other one is this one.
This guy's gas.
Gas.
You guys all right? I'm gonna mute that. I think Elliot's just accidentally unmuted his mic there. Thus I have all the control over the mics. The power. Okay, this is the water molecule and I think I wrote everything that I needed to do there. Tetrahedral bent 109.5 and bond angles of 109.5. And so this is the entire family, which is the tetrahedral family. So we're pulling this name, tetrahedral, and they all have the same parent electronic geometry because they all have four things bound to them. So what I'm doing is I'm taking this and saying, all right, this is four things. X3 plus E, four things. X2 plus E2, four things. And that's what I'm linking to tetrahedral, is I'm linking those four things to the tetrahedral family. But when I can't see the lone pairs, then I have these other geometry names that become very important. So trigonal pyramidal and bent. Tetrahedral, trigonal pyramidal, and bent are the three molecular structures that I see within that family. So Eric, gas comet got me thinking, is water vapor steam still H2O? Yes, it is. And so is ice. So water does not change whether it goes from gas to liquid to solid. It all has exactly the same structure, and its structure does not change at all, which is true. Okay, so this is one set of families. Then we have the second set of families, which start with AX3. So we're going to do the same thing. We're going to have, what did I call it? Abbreviation, molecule, electronic, molecular. So we'll have the abbreviation. We'll have a molecule. The parent geometry, which we think of as the this is the molecular, the electronic geometry. The molecular geometry name. And then we'll have a bond angle. So this family starts with AX3. A molecule like this, I usually like to do two different ones, but let me choose this one. And I'll draw its Lewis structure. This is formaldehyde. We could also do this one, which is called borane. They both are very similar. If we go and look at those, let's go and look at those, and then we'll build from the parent, the molecular, and the bond angle. We'll do all of that. We'll look at the geometry first.
When writing in the, when writing a 3D structure, how do you write double bonds? Just with the lines?
When I do a double bond, I'll show you. Hang on to that, and I'll bring that into the conversation. Here's the borane, and you can see the flat nature of the molecule, that there's three things connected to it and how flat it is, that all three of those things are in a plane. And that's the name that I give it, trigonal for three, planar because of their arrangement. So this is trigonal planar. If we go to the formaldehyde, you can see the double bond, but look at how the double bond makes no difference in the geometry. The geometry is still trigonal planar, and the double bond has no influence on the geometry. So double and triple bonds make no influence in the geometry. Not entirely true. They do change the three-dimensional shape a little bit, but not in this sort of idea or concept of the name that we're giving to the molecule and the bond angle. For instance, if I look at the bond angle, it's 120, this one's saying 122. If I go these two, it's 115. Idealized, the idealized bond angle comes when they're all symmetrical. So if I go back to borane, the idealized bond angle is 120. Split a circle into three equal parts and you get 120 degrees. And that's what this bond angle is. And it doesn't matter which of these I click on, they're all the same. So when I go back and look at this one, the parent electronic geometry of this is trigonal planar. The molecular geometry, because there are no lone pairs, is going to be the same, trigonal planar. And the idealized bond angle is 120 degrees. And how do I draw it with a double bond? What I try to do is I try to keep the double bond not on a hash or a wedge. I try to put the double bond in a straight line, or I orient the double bond towards the top and leave the other two in plane as well to show it sort of that way. But I try not to put the double bond either in a wedge position or a hash position, because that's very hard to draw or demonstrate.
So that's, but there's not always going to be that option, right?
Almost always.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can find ways around it. You can almost always find a way to orient it such that it's on the straight rather than on a wedge or a hash. It'll be fine. The next one is an AX2E. AX2E looks like this, SO2, where the sulfur has a lone pair on it. And in this, the sulfur has a lone pair, and the lone pair exerts a pressure on the oxygen. And because it exerts a pressure on the oxygen, it pushes down on them. It bends the bond angle. And so this one we call bent. It's still in the trigonal planar family. But its bond angle is 120, so this is bent 120. Let's go look at that one real quick and grab it. Here's the sulfur dioxide. And we can't see the lone pair, but we can measure the bond angle. And the bond angle, even though idealized is 120, this one's a little bit less. The lone pair is pushing even greater extent on these oxygens and pushing them a little bit tighter together. And we could grab that lone pair. I think I could probably calculate it. It should be this one. Ooh, that looks funky. Not quite as expected. That's because this is more of a molecular orbital than it is an atomic orbital. And the molecular orbitals are spread over the entire molecule. But this would be the orbital that the lone pair would reside in. And the big red lobe at the top, as I have it oriented right now, that big red lobe would be primarily where the lone pair would be situated. And that exerts a force which pushes the oxygens down and creates the geometry to a degree that we see. And so that is our bent at 120. Beyond that, we get an A. No, I can't go any further. That's it. That's the bottom of that geometry. So I only have two. I have trigonal planar, and I have bent at 120. And the last family that I have from this, so this is going into a new family. The last family is a true AX2. The AX2 family is something like carbon dioxide, CO2, which has no lone pairs on the central atom, the carbon, has lone pairs on the oxygens, but we don't count those. And this has a bond angle of 180 degrees. And as such, its geometries for its electronic geometry is linear. Its molecular geometry is linear. And its bond angle is 180 degrees. And if we go look at that one, let me go back here, job manager, carbon dioxide, you can see the linear nature of that molecule and how perfectly straight and linear it is. And if I measure the bond angles, it's a perfect 180 degrees. Eric, can I write wedges doubled up or dashes if need be? Yeah, you can always do that. It's a little bit harder to do though. Do these objects ever balance like a dreidel would? No, not exactly. They have a top and a bottom. No, they have no top or bottom. What they have is a dipole moment. And we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at dipole moments and understanding dipole moments. But no, they have no top or bottom. So they can be drawn and written in any direction. All right, so this is the families that I want you to memorize. I want you to be familiar with the tetrahedral family, and that is AX4, tetrahedral, AX3E, trigonal pyramidal, and AX2E2, bent. I want you to be familiar with the trigonal planar family, which is three things connected to a central. And so we have these three, which is taking me to the trigonal. Three things here, taking me to trigonal. That is the trigonal planar family. And the molecular geometry there that is bent. And then I have the AX2, which is electronic geometry and molecular geometry linear for the AX2. And we're going to leave the other families alone.
Question?
Yes.
For the AX4, how do we know where to put a wedge or the...
It's a little bit irrelevant. There's just one thing that you try not to do. For right now, it wouldn't make any difference, but later on in chemistry, it does. That when we do an AX4, and we put the A, that we like the hash bond and the wedge bond to be next to each other. We don't like to split, so it can go that way, or it can go this way, or any combination thereof. But what we don't like to do is to put the A and to put this bond and this bond separated in that way. We try not to put them apart from each other because otherwise it doesn't mean what we want it to mean. So what I'm doing here, or what I'm seeing, is that these two are next to each other, next to each other, next to each other, but not apart from each other, across the atom. Across the atom doesn't really make sense because you're saying that one is going forward and one is going back, but now that they're going across the atom, that doesn't feasibly make sense that these two could be top and bottom and in the plane at the same time. So that piece just doesn't make sense.
What about if you have like two wedges instead of the two lines? Would that just be the same thing?
We generally don't have two wedges. So I'll show you even on some larger molecules that there's ways to avoid it in drawing it so that you don't ever have that problem. Let me draw a large molecule. Or larger molecule. Let me think about what I want to draw. there are ways of orienting as you draw to try to keep everything lined up in a way that allows you to still see the three dimensions, but not put wedge bonds or hash bonds on things that have double bonds. And yet I can still go through this molecule and I can pick out different centers and their geometries and tell the bond angles. For instance, each one of these guys are tetrahedral in their geometry. So these are all tetrahedral centers that have bond angles of 109.5. The carbons that are these guys, oh, I should also say tetrahedral, that these are AX4s. The blue centers, these are trigonal planar. And are AX3s. And they have a bond angle that is 120 degrees. And this last one, which I didn't put the lone pairs on and I should have. I started drawing more in a organic sense. There we go. The last center is a bent 109.5. There we go. Bent 109.5 and is an AX2E2 and has bond angles of 109.5 in that bond angle. And so I get a three-dimensional sense out of drawing this molecule, even though it's a large molecule. Every center and the geometry at every center can be described. And I can use the wedge bonds and the hash bonds to denote where things are in the plane and where things are forwards and backwards. And all of that drawings allows me to give it some three-dimensional shape to it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. From here, what we like to do is we like to take and do some examples with VSEPR theory, take some molecules and draw some of the molecules and see what the structures are for these molecules. And let's see what we can do. Let's do a couple of examples. I think I have enough time to do two quick examples, one that might be a neutral molecule and one that might be charged. Draw the structure. Can't think of what structure I want to do. SOCl2, sulfur central, and give its shape. So we start off the same way that we did before. We have sulfur, oxygen, and chlorine. There's one sulfur, there is one oxygen, there are two chlorines. Sulfur is in group 6A, oxygen is in 6A, chlorine is in 7A. So this is 1 × 6, 1 × 6, 2 × 7. 6 × 6 = 12, and 14 would be 26 electrons. So I have a total of 26 electrons. I can take and connect each of the atoms to the central, and then go and give the more electronegative elements on the outside an octet, check and see how many electrons I've used. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24. I've used 24, but I have 26. I have two more electrons. Place them on the central element to give it an octet. So I've used 26 electrons. I have counted my octets, 8 electrons around oxygen, 8 around chlorine, 8 around chlorine, 8 around sulfur. Octets, check, formal charge. This is a neutral molecule, so as a neutral molecule, there really shouldn't be any formal charges. However, when I do this the fast way, and I look at how many electrons oxygen has, it's demonstrating 2, 4, 6, 7. It's supposed to come with 6, so that's a formal minus. And sulfur is supposed to have 6. And it's demonstrating 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it's demonstrating 5 electrons. And that means that it has a formal positive. And each of the chlorines, if I were to investigate chlorine, chlorine here would demonstrate 7. And it comes with 7, so that's 0. This chlorine would be the same, 7, and so that's 0. So it's really the sulfur and the oxygen. So my formal charges, that didn't work. So what I'll do is I'll make a double bond between the top oxygen and the sulfur. The lone pair doesn't go anywhere. Now I get 26 electrons. I've got an octet. For oxygen, check. For sulfur, I'm going to have 12 electrons. For chlorine, check. And 12 electrons is okay for sulfur. So it was 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Actually, it's 10 electrons, not 12. Good thing we counted. So I have an octet on oxygen, an octet on chlorine, and now 10 electrons on sulfur, which is okay. And formal charge-wise, I'll find that if I go through and do formal charge again, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oxygen's supposed to have 6, so it's neutral. Sulfur is supposed to have 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sulfur has 6. So my formal charge is checking. So this is the structure. This structure would be labeled an AX3E. I'm labeling the E, and I'm labeling the three X's. And my central element, that's how it's all labeling out. As an AX3E, this is 4 things bound to the central. So my geometry, if I'm looking at electronic, and my geometry for the molecular, electronic, this is tetrahedral. That sets my bond angle of 109.5. The molecular geometry where I can't see the lone pairs is this is going to be trigonal pyramidal. And when I draw its structure, the sulfur, if I take and put the double bonded oxygen over to the right, that will allow me to be able to put the chlorines left and right, forwards and backwards, and the lone pair, which would stick in the upwards direction. And that would give it its sort of bent geometry that would make it trigonal pyramidal. And I might be able to go and grab that structure. I don't know if I've calculated it yet, but I can go see if I've calculated it and show you what that structure looks like. Let me go see if I've got it. I don't have it. With the I don't have it with the chlorines, but I do have it. No, I'd have to calculate it for us. Let me see if I can do it. Maybe I can do it from here. WebMO, reset, job manager, new job. Create periodic table, sulfur, and then I need two chlorines and a double bond to an oxygen. And clean that up. And let's see if we can rotate that around. It looks flat, but when I go and send it to calculation, why can't I take this forward? Submit, MOPAC, geometry optimization, AM1, no, PM3 is good. Single multiplicity, go. Refresh, structure, bada bing, there it is. So I actually had to go through and do the calculation. And that calculation that it does is a fairly, it did it really, really fast, but that's because it's on a really fast server. That is a fairly intensive computation that it just did to try to figure out what the actual bond angles would be and where everything is going to be located. And you can see the double bonded nature of the oxygen, but there is a lone pair that sits up above this and the bond angles would be close to 109.5. If I measure them, they're going to be opened a little bit. That one's 97 because the chlorines are big. That's 104, so that gets closer to the 109.5. But that geometry would be called trigonal pyramidal because of it's shaped like a little pyramid. Just like we've drawn there.
Jason, when counting electrons, the single line that connects two atoms, that is a pair of shared electrons, correct?
That is correct.
But when we're counting the electrons for each atom, are you counting just one of those pairs?
When I do the count, let's say that I'm going to go through and count electrons, and I'm looking at this structure. Sometimes what I do is use multiple boxes to show what it is I'm counting or trying to count. So I think this is the question you're asking, is that what if I were going to count the electrons for the oxygen? Then what I do is in my electron count for oxygen, I get to count all of these electrons for oxygen. So that would be 2, 4, 5, 6, 2 electrons per bond, 7, 8 in that bond.
Yeah.
I'm literally counting them that way. When I count for the sulfur, I'm counting everybody that is in this box.
Okay, that's what I thought. I think I might have just misunderstood something or misheard you.
That's okay. So yeah, so I'm counting 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. I am double counting. I'm counting these both for the oxygen and for the sulfur, but that's what it means to share.
Right.
That's how I'm counting them. Okay, and Eric, ooh, do acetone. Oh, you wanted me to see to do acetone. Acetone is different. Acetone, interestingly, it's a great structure. Acetone is CH2O. And as such, when I make its Lewis structure, there is no lone pair on the hydrogen, on the carbon. So it has oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, 1 × 6, 1 × 4, 2 × 1. So that's 6, 4 is 10, and 2 is 12. So I've got 12 electrons total. And when I do that structure, I've got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. That's all the electrons. There is no lone pair on the carbon. This structure is acetone. No, this structure is formaldehyde. Ooh, acetone you wanted. It's almost identical, which is why I started to mess up. Acetone has, keep this image in mind of formaldehyde. And this image is an AX3. It is trigonal planar. It's in a flat plane, bond angles of 120. The acetone structure that you want is a structure that looks like this. It has two methyl groups. And as such, the carbon that is here and the carbon that is here are both AX3E. Nope, AX3, no E, just AX3. And that means that that bond angle is very similarly 120 degrees and is trigonal planar. However, this one out here, that's an AX4, and that's tetrahedral. And that bond angle is of 109.5. And I think I had acetone in the image over here, job manager, folder, VS EPR models, acetone. And there's that structure. And so you can see the trigonal planar nature of carbon number two and how carbon number two really is trigonal planar, flat, but carbons one and three are tetrahedral, having bond angles of 109.5. So what we get is that within molecules, we will find many different geometric centers. Each center has its own geometry. Each geometry can be given a name and a bond angle and relates to the overall molecular geometry. The overall molecular geometry does not have a name. We just give names to these centers within the molecule, such that we could call that center tetrahedral, that center trigonal planar. And looking at it, once you get experienced enough, you could look at a two-dimensional model and you can know what it looks like three-dimensionally, which is kind of cool.
I have one more question.
Of course.
Could you just scroll up a little bit? Right there, wouldn't that be E2?
Ooh, E2. I think you're asking me about two pairs, two electrons, and so it would be E2.
Mm-hmm.
We think of E as an electron pair. So
oh,
E,
I see.
So E is two electrons.
Got it. And then, so for example, if there's three electrons, what would, like three extra ones, how would
we don't that? Have anything for three electrons. We don't have anything for oddballs.
I was just testing you.
Okay. Lone electrons are called free radicals. Free radicals are very reactive types of molecules. There are molecules that have lone pairs of electrons, free radicals. The free radical, the single electron, does something a little bit different than electron pairs. And you're going to have to wait till Chem 12 before I get to tell you all about that. So you're going to have to come back in a year and take Chem 12 with me, and I will tell you all about free radicals.
Okay.
I'll give you lots of lectures about free radicals. Okay? Full of good questions. I love the good questions. All right, we're over time, people. I suggest we cut it, go get some lunch, come back for afternoon lecture. All right? Yeah, pomegranate juice. Get some good anti-radicals is what you need. Antioxidants, which is what prohibits free radicals, which are implicated in aging, the aging process, and in the process of eating and drinking and breathing. We create free radicals all the time within our body, and our body needs to find ways to deal with those free radicals, because those free radicals are what we think of as part of the aging process. Anyway, fun stuff, lots to talk about. I'll see you guys in the afternoon lab. Let's take a break. I gotta go get some lunch.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you guys later.